Thank you, Brother Chairman, my dear brothers and sisters, and my dear young people. Well, we left Jonathan, remember, on the occasion of our last study, having made those necessary arrangements with David in order that the king's heart and mind might be determined, and with a strategy devised whereby Jonathan could communicate the results to David, whether it be good or whether it be evil. And so we're told in the 24th verse of the 1st of Samuel 20, "So David hid himself in the field, and when the new moon was come, the king sat down to meat." You'll notice there's a colon halfway through that verse. And I think the phrase, "So David hid himself in the field," really becomes the end of this first half of the chapter, as it were. So these arrangements having been concluded, David came at the end of the third day at the appointed time and hid himself in the field, colon. And a colon, of course, marks a break in thought. And now the scene changes back to the court of the king and to the palace of the king. And now the scene goes back to this most delicate of occasions, when Jonathan is now going to have to see what his father's heart and mind is, and he's going to endeavour to plead the cause of his dear friend in the presence of his father. Now, I'll tell you what, brothers and sisters and young people, these verses are charged with interest. Now, just have a look what it says, verse 25. It says, "And the king sat upon his seat as at other times, even upon a seat by the wall, and Jonathan arose, and Abner sat by Saul's side, and David's seat was empty." The king sat upon his seat as at other times, even upon a seat by the wall. Now, why would a king want to sit in a seat by the wall? And the answer is, of course, that if he can sit in a seat by the wall, with the wall behind him, and a good friend on either side of him, then he's protected himself from assassination attempts, hasn't he? You see, Saul is becoming fearful of his position. He's obsessed with this now. He's eaten out by it. He's suspicious of everyone. Whatever anybody says, whatever move they make, Saul's watchful eyes are always shifting around. He's consumed by this problem. He's sitting in a seat by the wall to protect himself. That was always Saul's problem, wasn't it? How can I protect my royal authority? And you see what the verse goes on to say? It says, "And Jonathan arose." But the Revised Version and the Jerusalem Bible and the New International Version and the Amplified Bible and a number of other translations render the text, "And Jonathan sat opposite." Not Jonathan arose, but Jonathan sat opposite. And what we're being told in the 25th verse is the seating arrangements of the table. So we've got Saul sitting on a seat by the wall, and opposite him, facing across, was his son, Jonathan. Jonathan was sitting opposite his father. And Abner sat by Saul's side, and David's place was empty. You know, you get the sense here that there's four people at a table, don't you? And on the one side is Saul with his back to all, and who's alongside him? Abner. And on the other side of the table, one spot is occupied by Jonathan, who's sitting opposite his father, and the other seat is noticeably empty, and that's David's place. You see, David would have quite reasonably had a seat at the king's table, because just think about it. First of all, he was now one of Saul's chief captains. First point. Second point, he was the king's son's friend, Jonathan, and thirdly, he was the king's son-in-law. He had now married Saul's daughter. So he's perfectly entitled to be sitting at the royal table. So David's got a seat on the other side of the table as well. Now what about this Abner fellow, Abner who sat by Saul's side? Well, Abner, of course, we're told in the 14th chapter and in the 50th verse, was Saul's own uncle. He was, in fact, the man that Saul had put in charge of the army. And if we were to ask what was the spirit of Abner, we would have to say that Abner's spirit was that he was a man deeply committed to preserving the house of Kish upon the throne. That was always Abner's ambition. When Saul was removed, it's Abner, isn't it, who takes Ish-bosheth and puts Ish-bosheth, one of the remaining sons of Saul, as a puppet upon the kingdom, and thereafter guides the kingdom behind the scenes. Abner, who was always there to promote the house of Saul, and particularly the house of Kish. And he's sitting there as well at the table. A man who championed the cause of the house of Saul. He's sitting alongside Saul. So you see, there's Saul and Abner on one side of the table, and there's Jonathan on the other side. The phrase is rendered, Jonathan sat opposite. You know, brothers and sisters, how deeply symbolic that is. That is exactly where Jonathan was. He was opposite his father. And that's where he's going to be in this story. He sat exactly opposite to his father. That's exactly where Jonathan was in relationship to his father's spirit and his father's feelings, and that's going to be revealed in this particular chapter. And you know, it's one of those things, isn't it? You know, you could just imagine if there was a table like that. Imagine coming to dinner. Supper? Meal? Well, whatever it is that they came to. Imagine coming to the meal, and there's Saul sitting down with his javelin in his hand, and there's Abner sitting alongside, and there's Jonathan now coming to the table, and he knew the matter was going to come up at some stage of David not being there. And you know what it would be like? You'd come to the table, wouldn't you, and you'd be awfully conscious of that empty seat. Hello, Dad. Hello, Uncle Abner. Hope they don't notice the empty seat. Of course they notice the empty seat. You know, you can really see the tension building in this narrative. Now look what happens, verse 26. Nevertheless, although David's place was empty, it says, nevertheless Saul spake not anything that day, for he thought something hath befallen him. The Jerusalem Bible says, something's happened. Rotherham says, it is an accident. Do you know what the accident was that Saul thought had happened to David? He thought that he had been made in some way ceremonially unclean. Rotherham translates the balance of the verse. Rotherham says, he is not clean because he has not been cleansed. The Septuagint says, he is not clean because he has not been purified. So what happened was, Saul did see the empty seat, and his first reaction was, well, David's obviously contracted some form of ceremonial defilement. Interesting, isn't it, that even though Saul hated David, that his first thought about why David might not be there at the table is that his absence was in some way related to religious things. He ceremonially defiled. Even Saul, who hated David, that was his first thought as to why David wouldn't be there. But there was a problem, you see. And the problem was that Leviticus 1 verse 24 and Leviticus 15 verse 10 said that ceremonial defilement, ceremonial uncleanness, ended at even. And verse 27 says, and it came to pass on the morrow, after the even had passed, which was the second day of the month, that David's place was empty, and Saul said, oh, he saw it quick as a flash. As soon as David wasn't there, the next day, Saul had picked up the matter straight away. He knew there was something going on. He knew there was something wrong. Remember, he's a brooding, suspicious character, and Saul immediately suspects that something is afoot. And look what he says. He says, verse 27, he said unto Jonathan, wherefore cometh not the son of Jesse to meet neither yesterday nor today? Oh, do you see what he said? He said, wherefore cometh the son of Jesse? Do you know that up to this time in the record, Saul has always called him David. He's always called him David. And now for the first time, he doesn't call him David, he calls him the son of Jesse. Just see how that's taken up in the record. Verse 30, Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan, and he said unto him, thou son of the perverse, rebellious woman, do not I know that thou hast chosen the son of Jesse to thine own confusion? Verse 31, for as long as the son of Jesse liveth upon the ground. You know why he called him the son of Jesse? Because at that moment, Saul hated David so much that he couldn't even bear to use his name. And so he called him the son of Jesse. You know who Jesse was? Jesse was the Bethlehemite, wasn't he? And Bethlehem is described in Micah chapter 5, thou Bethlehem Ephratah, though thou be little among the thousands of Judah. So Bethlehem was a little insignificant village in the territory. And within Bethlehem, Jesse was just one little family, and David was one insignificant son in that family, the son of Jesse. It was a term of contempt, as far as Saul was concerned. He just couldn't use the term David. Can we have a look at chapter 22? chapter 22, verse 8. You see, he got to that stage where he just couldn't stand the thought of David, not even the use of his name. The 1 Samuel 22, verse 8. He says, "All of you have conspired against me, and there's none that showeth me that my son hath made a league with the son of Jesse." Now, to show you that that's right, come to chapter 24. In the 1 Samuel 24, remember when David, we've already looked at this, he cut off a part of the skirt of Saul. Verse 9, "And David said to Saul, Wherefore hearest thou men's words, saying, Behold, David seeketh thy hurt? Behold, this day thine eyes have seen, now that Yahweh hath delivered thee today into mine hand in the cave, and some bade me kill thee, but mine eye spared thee. And I said, I will not put forth mine hand against my Lord, for he is Yahweh's anointed. Moreover, my father, see, yea, the skirt of thy robe in mine hand." And David appeals to Saul. And look what Saul says, verse 16. "And it came to pass, when David had made an end of speaking these words unto Saul, that Saul said, Is this thy voice, my son, David?" He's back to normal now, you see. The fit of rage has passed. Saul's back to ordinary life again. "My son David." But he's not like that back in chapter 20, is he? He's full of brooding hostility. And so he says in the 1st of Samuel 20, in verse 27, "Wherefore cometh not the son of Jesse to meet? Neither yesterday nor today." And you know who'd be quick to pick up immediately that change of address? Jonathan would see that straight away, wouldn't he? Jonathan would immediately hear that changed form of address that his father has used on this particular occasion. And so now the moment of destiny has come, that time when Jonathan's going to have to stand up and speak for his friend. And there's the king looking at him with crafty eyes. And Jonathan is about to try and now intercede for his friend, to plead the cause of David yet again. And I just look, it was a moment that Jonathan had absolutely dreaded. I can just imagine him at that table the previous day. He arrives at the table as this glaringly empty seat. Gladad, Gladnet. Every mouthful seemed to take an age to chew through. The whole meal seemed to drag on and on and on. By the time he got to the meal and Saul hadn't said anything, off he goes. Back to meal the next day, and out comes these words, "Why isn't the son of Jesse here?" And Jonathan knew that this was the moment of truth. He was feeling nervous. He was feeling edgy. He wasn't just worried about himself. Well, he wasn't really worried about himself at all. He was upset. He was fearful for David. And he was also fearful for his father as to what Saul's attitude would be. He was worried about David, and he was worried about his father and about his father's position before God. And just to make matters worse, great Uncle Abner was watching across the table with bushy eyebrows as well. And now Jonathan's going to have to come with his explanation. Oh, it wasn't a good time. And so this is what he says. Now I'll tell you what, you've got to read this story carefully. Look, verse 28. It's all to do with good Bible reading. This is what he said, verse 28. "Jonathan answered Saul." He says, "David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem." Where do those words come from? Where do those words come from? They're from verse 6, aren't they? That is the agreed statement that they had. That's verbatim from the statement that David had mentioned in verse 6. "David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem." So that bit's okay. Now verse 29. "And he said, Let me go, I pray thee, for our family hath a sacrifice in the city." Where does that come from? Well, that's really the balance of verse 6, isn't it? "For there is a yearly sacrifice there for all the family." So you see, up to that point of time, what Jonathan has quoted verbatim is that which he had agreed with David to say. This was what they were going to say. But bear in mind, as we've suggested, I think David really had gone down to his family. So you see, what happens was, Jonathan is looking at his father. His father's looking at him. Uncle Abner's there. And Jonathan says, verse 28, now comes the rehearsed speech, you see. So away it goes. He says, "Well, David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem. And he said, Let me go, I pray thee, for our family have a sacrifice in the city."
He looks at his father.
And my brother, he commanded me to be there. And he looks at Uncle Abner. And now David said, if I found favour in thine eyes, let me get away, I pray thee, and see my brethren. He looks at them again. Therefore he cometh not under... He couldn't stop himself.
Jonathan's nervous. Jonathan's very nervous. Because he knew that the two men on the other side of the table, just from looking at them, obviously didn't believe him. And when you're nervous like that and you're under pressure, what tends to happen is you go on and on and on, and you add a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more, and the story gets more and more sticky, and you feel more and more flustered. And Jonathan made a mistake, and he said something he should never have said. You know what that was? In verse 29, he said, as he embellished the story out and out and out, he says, "And now if I've found favour in thine eyes, let me get away." Oh, he should never have said that. That was a wrong word to choose. Do you know that the word get away there, malat in the Hebrew, means to escape by slipperiness. It's the word translated in chapter 19 when Saul threw a javelin at David. It says, "And David fled and escaped that night." That's the 1st of Samuel 19, verse 10. It's the same word translated in Daniel 11, when the king of the north comes down. It says, "These shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon." It means to, as it were, to slip out of the clutches of someone at the last moment. Oh, he never should have used that word, should he? "Let me slither away, I pray thee." Oh, that was the wrong thing to say to Saul about David. And so verse 30 says that Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan. And he said unto him, "Thou son of the perverse, rebellious woman, do not I know that thou hast chosen the son of Jesse to thine own confusion, unto the confusion of thy mother's nakedness?" You see, really, Saul didn't have anything to answer. He was unable to reproach Jonathan, really. And so what he does is he endeavours to vilify Jonathan by insulting his mother. Do you know that that was the worst insult that you could offer an Oriental? Was to say something insulting or disrespectful about their mother. And that's what he does. And this is his own wife he's talking about, isn't it? "Thou son of the perverse, rebellious woman." The word woman is there in italics, but it does mean that in the sense of the text. The Jerusalem Bible says, "Thou son of a wanton." Well, do you know who Jonathan's mother was? If you come back to if you come back a few chapters to whereabouts is it? Chapter 14. If you come back to chapter 14 and perhaps verse 49 for connection. Here's the woman that Saul is talking about. "Now the sons of Saul were Jonathan and Ishui and Melchishua. And the names of his two daughters were these, the name of the firstborn Merab, and the name of the younger Michal. And the name of Saul's wife was Ahinoam." And Ahinoam means brother of pleasantness. You don't have to worry about the word brother, because the force of the word brother, idiomatically in the Hebrew, really stands here for that which stands related to pleasantness. Brother of pleasantness, that which is related to pleasantness. Brother of pleasantness. And I think we're being told here that Jonathan's sweetness and Jonathan's humility and Jonathan's courage and Jonathan's godliness all sprang from his mother. It certainly didn't come from his father, did it? A truer statement in the 20th chapter would have been for Saul to say, "Thou son of a perverse, rebellious father." That would have been closer to the truth. I don't think his mother was like that at all. Where did Jonathan get those virtuous qualities that he had? And maybe if she was such a woman involved with pleasant and good things, a woman who had mothered such a marvellous son, maybe she also had stood apart from the worst excesses of Saul and therein had incurred the anger and wrath of her husband. And so back to the 1st of Samuel chapter 20 and verse 30. Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan. He said, "Thou son of the perverse, rebellious woman, do not I know that thou hast chosen the son of Jesse to thine own confusion? For as long," verse 31, "for as long as the son of Jesse liveth upon the ground, thou shalt not be established, nor thy kingdom. Wherefore now send and fetch him unto me, for he shall surely die." This is an amazing statement when you think about it that Saul makes. He says, "For as long as the son of Jesse liveth upon the ground, thou shalt not be established, nor thy kingdom." But Samuel had said to Saul, in the 1st of Samuel 13 and verse 14, he said, "Thy kingdom shall not continue." And in the 15th chapter, in the 28th verse, Samuel had said to Saul, "Yahweh hath rent the kingdom from thee." Do you know what we're being told here in the 20th chapter in verse 31? Saul never accepted what Samuel had said. He acts as if Jonathan had the right and the ability to carry on the kingdom of Saul. Saul never accepted what Samuel had said, that his kingdom was finished. And you know what he's really saying in the 31st verse here? Do you know what Saul's really saying? What he's saying is this. He says to Jonathan, he says, "Look, son, you've got to realize that there's a choice in life here. You've either got to give up your friendship with David, or you've got to give up the hope of inheriting the material possessions of the kingdom. It's one or other. And you've got to appreciate that, son," says Saul. "It's material considerations versus spiritual ones." And there's a dramatic confrontation here between a father and son who are hopelessly apart with regard to their thinking and their attitude towards life. You see, what Saul said was this. He said, "Look, son," he says, "you've got to get your priorities in life sorted out." He says, "You secure your kingdom first. You get your possessions organized. You establish your power base. And then you worry about other things, including friends and so on, and the truth later. Get your priorities sorted out." Jonathan's feeling was, "My friendship with David comes first. I will put the things of the Spirit first, and only after that will I worry about other things finding their place." These two men were hopelessly apart. And Saul's advice to his own son was, "You get life sorted out first. Worry about the truth later. You get your kingdom organized." And that's the spirit that can happen in the truth, isn't it? A young person at the crossroads thinks he might take further education. Also close to baptism. "Don't worry about baptism now. You go to university and you get your degree organised. Worry about the baptism later. That'll come." I've got nothing against tertiary education, by the way. But I do have, if it's a choice between that and the truth, and the truth is put to one side, you don't ever do that. That's not putting the truth first. There's lots of times in life where we've got to make a choice between material considerations and worldly considerations versus the truth. Which one really does come first in your life, in your family's life? What do you teach your children? We teach our children by what we do and what we say and what we practice ourselves. Saul's advice to his son was, "Get life organized first. Worry about the truth later." That's not good advice, brothers and sisters. And that's not the advice of a spiritually minded father. You know, the spirit that we understand from Matthew chapter 6, isn't it? "Seek ye first the kingdom of God, and all these things shall be added unto you." You know, that wouldn't have worked for David, Matthew chapter 6. Sorry, that wouldn't have worked for Jonathan. Do you know what it meant for Jonathan to put the truth first? To rephrase Matthew chapter 6, "Seek ye first the kingdom of David, and all these things shall be taken away from you." Isn't that what Jonathan was facing? Had he still decided that his friendship with David And their loyalty together to Yahweh and the things of the truth was the primary consideration. Saul didn't understand that the very basis of their friendship was that Jonathan acknowledged the superior right of David to the throne of the kingdom. And verse 32 says, "And Jonathan answered Saul his father, and said unto him, Wherefore shall he be slain? What hath he done?" You know, Jonathan didn't answer what his father had said at all. You see, Saul said two things, verse 31. The first thing he said was, "For as long as the son of Jesse liveth upon the ground, thou shalt not be established, nor thy kingdom." And then he said, "Fetch him, and he'll die." And Jonathan never ever answers the first part of Saul's statement to him in verse 31. Doesn't even bother to reply to that. As far as Jonathan was concerned, that was so wrong, so unscriptural, that it didn't even warrant a reply. You do not put the world first in life. Never. That's a principle of the truth, isn't it? That's a first principle of the truth. Jonathan doesn't even answer that. The thing he does take up concerning his father was the challenge to David's life. And so he says, verse 32, "Wherefore shall he be slain? What hath he done?" And with characteristic frankness and braveness, he pleads the cause of his dear friend. You know, Ecclesiastes 8 verse 4 says, "With the king there is power. And who shall tell him, what doest thou?" And that's what life was like in the presence of a king, wasn't it? And Jonathan needed to have tremendous courage to stand up to his father and to say, as he did in verse 32, "Wherefore shall he be slain? What hath he done?" Here's loyalty, brothers and sisters, at a very, very difficult time. And that's one of the principles of friendship, isn't it? One of the first principles of friendship. A friend loveth at all times, and a brother is born for adversity, says Proverbs 17 and verse 17. It's no good just having friends that are friends in good times. A true friend is one who's loyal to you in difficult times, and that's what Jonathan showed here. A man of many companions may come to ruin, but there is a friend who sticketh closer than a brother, Proverbs 18, verse 24. And here's what we looked at in the daily readings yesterday. Psalm 15. Yahweh, who shall abide in thy tabernacle? He that backbiteth not with his tongue, nor doeth evil to his friend, nor endureth a reproach against his neighbour. And what happened on this occasion was that Saul was going to reproach David, and Jonathan would not endure that reproach against his friend. He stood against it. "In whose eyes a vile person is condemned, Saul, but he honoureth them that fear Yahweh," Jonathan stood for David. "He that sweareth to his own hurt and changeth not, Yahweh be between me and thee forever, and when thou art king, remember thy kindness towards me." And that which Jonathan had sworn with an oath to David was very much to his own hurt, wasn't it? It involved the loss of everything he could have had, everything he could have been, all the power he could have enjoyed. But there was no question that Jonathan would never ever change from that which he'd sworn. That's the principle of true loyalty, isn't it, to those who are our friends. So you see what happens. Verse 33. "So now the battle's joined between father and son. And Saul cast a javelin at him to smite him, whereby Jonathan knew that it was determined of his father to slay David." Why did Saul cast a javelin to smite Jonathan? I think there were two reasons. The first reason was because he had no answer to what Jonathan had said. Jonathan had said, "What has he done? Why should he be slain?" And because Saul had no answer, he simply grabbed his javelin and went, "Whoa!" Because he knew there was no answer, and so he just reacted with physical violence. That's often the case. When a person hasn't got an answer, you resort to violence, don't you? And the second reason, I believe, is that Saul was so consumed with malice against David that at this moment, just for a moment, just for a brief moment, he actually hated Jonathan because of his association with David. So consumed was Saul about David that for that moment Jonathan stood for David, and he hated that man and he threw a javelin. And as a result of that, we're told that, in fact, look how remarkably the verse is written, verse 33. Look at the spirit of Jonathan. Saul cast a javelin at Jonathan, whereby Jonathan knew that it was determined of his father to slay David. I mean, you would have thought it would be, worded to say that he threw a javelin at him, whereby he knew it was determined of his father to slay him. No, he says he knew from the fact that the javelin whistled past his ear that his father was going to slay David. He had no thought for himself, did he? He was absolutely consumed and absorbed in furthering David's cause, his friend. He wasn't worried about himself. As the javelin whistled past and thudded into the wall, Jonathan's first thought was, my dad really does want to kill David. That's remarkable, isn't it? And isn't that the spirit of Luke? Isn't that the spirit of the Lord's words in John? If they have hated me, they will hate you. If they've hated me, says the Lord, the David, the beloved, they will hate you, the disciples, the Jonathan, because of their association of friendship. And so verse 34 says, so Jonathan arose from the table in fierce anger and did eat no meat the second day of the month, for he was grieved for David because his father had done him shame. The Septuagint version says, Jonathan sprang up from the table in great anger. Oh, can you see this scene? So there's Saul on the one side with his back to the wall, gets the javelin and throws it to Jonathan. Jonathan dodges. And then he looks at his father and it says that he sprang up from the table in great anger. Rotherham says he rose up from the table in a glow of anger. Oh, he might have been Ahinoam's son and he might have had his sweetness, her sweetness, but he had a little bit of his father's spark in him as well, didn't he? And he arose, it says, in fierce anger from the table. But you know what's remarkable about this particular verse? It says that he did eat no meat the second day of the month. You know what that really means? When it says that he didn't eat any meat? What it really means is that he got up and he walked out. That's what it means. He did eat no meat. He left the table. He walked away. He did not retaliate. He went out and he took his anger with him. He didn't try to fight hatred with hatred. When he was reviled, he reviled not again. This is Proverbs 14. Go from the presence of a foolish man when thou perceivest not in him the lips of knowledge. And he left the room. We've got the anger of two men, marvellously contrasted here. The anger of Saul, hopelessly uncontrolled and bitter of spirit. Jonathan's, strongly governed and under the principle of his own personal discipline, self-control. That's the lesson of Jonathan, isn't it, in this verse? It's a very difficult thing at times to learn, especially when we're under extreme provocation. Ephesians says, be ye angry and sin not. Let not the sun go down upon your wrath. Proverbs 16 says, he that is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he that ruleth his spirit than he that taketh a city. James says, let every man be slow to wrath, for the wrath of man worketh not the righteousness of God. The 2 Peter 1 says, add to your faith virtue, and to virtue knowledge, and to knowledge self-control. And Proverbs again says, he that is slow to wrath is of great understanding. And although Jonathan stood to lose so much, he sought to be one with David. He was prepared to resign his personal ambitions. He was prepared to make David's hope his hope. He becomes a disciple of Christ. He becomes typical of the disciples of Christ in their loyalty to the Lord, that we resign our own ambitions and we make the Lord's hope our hope. And we become loyal to him, whatever it might be. You see what the verse goes on to say? It says he was grieved for David because his father had done him shame. The NIV says he was grieved at his father's shameful treatment of David. So is that our spirit? When we're in the courts of the world, are we grieved at the world's shameful treatment of the Lord? So the little jokes in the lunch place that are really a bit smutty, the use of the Lord's name in vain, do we laugh along with everyone else? or do we stand up and walk away? And are we grieved in heart because they have done shame unto the beloved? What's our spirit? Do we stand with our friend in the courts of the world? I tell you what, you've really got to see that verse 34. I can just see this verse, brothers and sisters. Look, what happens is the javelin gets thrown, Saul is sitting there, his chest heaving, Jonathan springs up from the table, and I think what he does, he looked across the table, his eyes blazed at his father. And you could see he was like that, and then he just took hold of himself and he turned on his heel and he walked out. And you know what he did? He offered his back to his father. And he said, "Thrust me through if you want to, but I'm for David." And in walking out as he did, and in taking his anger with him, Jonathan really did show all the world what he stood for. That's a marvellous spirit in a man, isn't it? That was tremendous personal control. Verse 35. Came to pass in the morning that Jonathan went out into the field at the time appointed with David, and a little lad with him. A little lad. You see the force of the word? A little lad. Why a little lad? Why not a bigger boy? Well, because you see, he was going to shoot the arrows now to give a warning to David. And you see, if it was a little lad, just a little boy, then the little boy wouldn't be suspicious of what was going on as Jonathan shot the arrows and cried out certain things. And the little boy would never pick up that there was something going on behind the story of the firing of the arrows. So he took just a little lad with him, one who would not be suspicious of the circumstances. And out they went into the field. And verse 36 says, he said unto the lad, he said, "Run and find out now the arrows which I shoot." And as the lad ran, he shot an arrow beyond him. And when the lad was come to the place of the arrow which Jonathan had shot, Jonathan cried after the lad and said, "Is not the arrow beyond thee?" Now, you see, that statement there, "Is not the arrow beyond thee?" That was the agreed thing that he would say, wasn't it? Back in verse 22. "But if I say thus unto the young man, behold, the arrows are beyond thee, go thy way, for Yahweh hath sent thee away." And so, as Jonathan fired the arrow over the little boy's head, and then he cries out, apparently, in this deserted field, he says, "Is not the arrow beyond thee?" It was really saying to David that any hope of reconciliation with Saul was now lost. Verse 38. "And Jonathan cried after the lad, Make speed, haste, stay not." Why do you think he said that? Why did he need to tell the little lad to run so quickly? "Make speed," he says. The Jerusalem Bible says, "Be quick, hurry, do not stand about." So I said, if Jonathan was a little bit short with the boy. No, I don't think he was. You see, the lad thought that these words were directed to him. "Run along, hurry up there, make speed." But they weren't really being directed to the little lad at all, were they? It was actually a message for David. "Run, brother. Speed thee, brother, on thy way." Isn't that what Jonathan was saying? As he passes a message to his dear friend. Verse 39. "Jonathan's lad gathered up the arrows and came to his master, but the lad knew not anything," says verse 39. Only Jonathan and David knew the matter. The lad never did guess what was going on. And so the lad knew not anything, it says. Only Jonathan and David. Only Jonathan and David knew the matter. Verse 39. There's a good principle in that too, isn't there? Because true friends learn the secret of trust in one another, don't they? Remember Psalm 41? "Mine own familiar friend in whom I trusted." Isn't that what true friendship's built out of? The word familiar is shalom, that which stands for peace and unity and harmony and safety. My own safe friend, the one that I can rely on, the one that I can always trust in, that I'll be safe with this person. Job 19:19. "All my inward friends," says Job, and the margin says, "the men of my secret." Oh, what a lovely description of a close friend, the men of my secret. Proverbs 11 says, "A talebearer revealeth secrets, but he that is of a faithful spirit concealeth the matter." That's what good friends are like. Proverbs 17 says, "He that covereth a transgression seeketh love, but he that repeateth a matter separateth very friends." True friends don't pass on confidences. True friends place implicit trust in one another in the knowledge that what they have said will never ever be reported to somebody else. True friends don't do that. And sometimes there are those in ecclesial life, again, that would love to have a dear friend, would love to have a close friend, a special friend in the truth. But they have a problem. They've never learned how to keep secrets. And if you can't learn how to keep secrets and to guard the doors of your mouth, you never ever will find a close friend. Because true friendship is founded on the principle of trust. And so it says, only Jonathan and David knew of the matter. It was the secret between them. No one else did know. David's secrets were safe with Jonathan. Jonathan would never ever say. Jonathan would never ever reveal what David had spoken to him in confidence. Verse 41, "And as soon as the lad was gone, David arose out of his place toward the south and fell on his face to the ground." As soon as the lad was gone, David arose out of his place. And you think, well, that's funny. If the whole reason for the arrows was so that they didn't have to reveal themselves to one another, why go through all the business of the arrows? And you see, I think what happened was that the arrows were there to protect David just in case Jonathan had been spied on. But what happened is they went out into the field with the little lad. Jonathan had a sharp eye all about him. He'd been watching from the moment he'd left the palace. And he was satisfied by the time that he'd come to the end of this little episode in the field that there was nobody there. Nobody at all. And so he gives the weapons, he gives his artillery, his bows and his arrows to the little lad. He says, "Run off to the city, go back home, son. You drop those off at my place. Off you go now," pats him on the shoulder. The little lad runs off and Jonathan stays there because it is safe now. The moment's clear. It's all okay. And both Jonathan and David no doubt would have wanted this last chance, this last opportunity for some words together. And so what happens was, it says that David arose out of his place toward the south. Actually, Rotherham says he arose from beside the mound. And that was the place that was agreed, you see, where he should have been staying in verse 19. So he was hiding behind a little hillock. And as the little lad ran off and disappeared into the distance, David gets up and he walks around, comes from in behind the mound, walks out and he walks towards David. It's all okay, he walks towards Jonathan. The coast is clear now, there's no need for secrecy. And as David walks towards Jonathan, all of a sudden, the verse says, verse 41, all of a sudden David falls flat on his face in front of Jonathan. He falls to the ground and he bows himself in front of Jonathan. And he doesn't just bow once, he does it once and then he does it again and then he does it for a third time. Why did David bow before Jonathan? Well, I believe that the reason why he did that was he was acknowledging Jonathan's royal status. He was, after all, the king's son. He bows before him as the king's son, and in bowing before him, you know what I think David was saying? I think David was saying, "I want you to understand, Jonathan, that I really do have no ambition to assume the throne in your place, dear friend." And he bowed before him. You see, they really loved each other, these two. And David wanted Jonathan to understand that he had no ambition to supplant Jonathan. It might have been the way of God, but David didn't want to do that at the expense of Jonathan, his friend. And so he bows himself three times, and then it says, "And they kissed one another and wept one with another." Green's translates the balance of the verse, "And they each one kissed his friend, and they each wept on his friend until David exceeded." The word "exceeded" here means to weep loudly. David broke down. Brothers and sisters, David broke down completely. He burst into tears. He's the younger of the two, you see. He's more uncertain. He hasn't got the same maturity. He's not used to the trials of life. He just couldn't cope with this. And David, as he weeps upon Jonathan's shoulder, breaks down completely. Great sobbing, convulsive cries. Until David exceeded, says the record. Must have been a tremendously emotional moment, a dramatic moment for both these friends. And one can imagine Jonathan similarly checked with emotion as the two wept on one another's shoulders. And isn't it characteristic in this story that in verse 42, who is it that takes charge of the situation? Who is it that tries to bring things back onto an even keel? It's Jonathan, isn't it? The wiser, the older, the more mature of these two. And Jonathan said to David, go in peace. It's Jonathan that has to take charge of the situation. Because David's so young. David is so inexperienced. David is sobbing with tears. And doesn't that make all the more remarkable the fact that this man, Jonathan, was prepared to give everything away to this boy that lies crying in front of him? What a remarkable, amazing spirit that is. And this was a moment, of course, of great tragedy in their friendship. You know, these two were the closest, dearest of friends. I don't think there'd ever been, in the Bible record, I don't think there's ever been a record of a story between two brethren like this, has there? Not really. They're the closest of brethren. And all they both knew now was that some dreadful circumstance was going to rip them asunder. And they had the most wonderful friendship you could ever imagine, and now it was going to be broken in two. And they might never, ever meet each other again. Who knows? They didn't know. That was the whole point. They didn't know. They didn't know what the future held. For all they knew, this could be the last time they ever would see each other. And you see what Jonathan says? He says, go in peace. Shut up. For as much as we have sworn, both of us, in the name of Yahweh, saying, Yahweh be between me and thee, and between my seed and thy seed forever. And in spite of everything that was happening, Jonathan now gently reminds David that there would ultimately be eternal unity between them. There'll be everlasting peace between us, David, because Yahweh is between us. Whatever we have, and wherever you might be, and wherever I might be, and whatever circumstances might come between us, we will always be together, because God's between us. Don't ever forget that, David, says Jonathan. He says he'll be between us forever. You know, Jonathan uses that term three times in this chapter. In fact, when you think about this chapter is saturated with the number three, which is the number of covenant. David makes three complaints. Jonathan issues three denials. There's three statements of love. He loved them because he loved them as he loved his own soul. There's 3 days. There's 3 arrows. There's 3 times that David bows before his friend. There's 3 times that Jonathan uses the term forever. Everything about this story is saturated with the idea of covenant relationships, the number three. And I can just imagine how it finished. The final hug between the two. Scalding tears. Broken hearts. You see what it says? It says at the end, and he arose and departed, and arose, that is David, that David arose and departed, and Jonathan went into the city. You know, brothers and sisters, every jot and tittle of the divine record is important. See what it actually says? It says, and he arose and departed, and then there's a colon. And then after the colon, it says, and Jonathan went into the city. You know what I think that tells us? I think that tells us that after they embraced for the final time, that Jonathan actually stood and watched David walk away. And so when it says that David arose and departed, then there's a break. And it's not until David's gone that the record then says, and then Jonathan went into the city. And he watched David walk away, a young man with a heavy burden on his shoulders. And Jonathan could still feel the tears pricking at his own eyes. And he watched David as he walked away, walked away, walked away. Goodbye, dear friend. He never ever did know if he would see him again. Until finally David was a dot on the horizon. And only then did Jonathan turn around and retrace his steps back to the king's court and to the king's house and to a mad father. And Jonathan knew that his life would never be the same again. Which of the two do you think had the more difficult task to face? I think it was Jonathan, as he went back to try and live in the court of his father, and to still be faithful to his father, to still be loyal to his father, yet love his friend and be faithful to his God. Jonathan the intercessor, earnest entreaty and bitter separation. Friendship with Christ inevitably begins to separate us from those that are hostile to him. Yet true friendship is constant. It's unaffected by changes in circumstance. It's marked in the disciples by that stand of loyalty that yields first place to Christ in all that we do in the truth. Jonathan revealed this spirit by being fearless and earnest in entreaty for his friend and utterly thoughtless of danger or deprivation to himself. Right conduct in the truth demands the discipline of self-control. Those who practice friendship also practice trust. And they learn to give and also to receive secrets, and how to guard them faithfully. They're good lessons, aren't they, from the life of this wonderful, wonderful man who stood until his friend disappeared on the horizon, having said unto him, Yahweh be between me and thee, and between my seed and thy seed forever.